Today's episode is brought to you by Warby Parker. Please visit warbyparker.com/lawpod for your next pair of eyeglasses.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman.
Due to habeas corpus, you and Miss Bonifante had a common law marriage.
So you don't work on a contingency basis?
No. Money down. Oops, shouldn't have this bar association logo here either.
Would you please point at that robot over there? No further questions.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 76. Oh, it's a Comey testimony day. Andrew, how are you doing over there?
I am doing fantastic. I just want to point out the level of commitment that I have to our listeners. Multiple DC bars were having Comey testimony day specials, including giving out free drinks at various points throughout the hearing. And I stayed in my home studio and watched it while sober order that we could get here and record in the afternoon.
See, I would have helped you spin it the other way. Like, had you told me right now, like, yeah, here's my dedication. I went to the bar and drank like five drinks because I had to be there to see. I would have helped you spin that way, but it's okay. You went the other way. No problem.
No, and I think we learned. Look, I think we learned a lot of really interesting things, which we'll get into in the main segment
about John McCain's mental state.
I think we learned one thing that people should have already known about John McCain's mental state, but we'll get to that too.
All right. Well, we'll get to that later, but for now, let's get to our first segment.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
Uh-oh, Andrew. You were wrong again? What is this? This cannot be right. This must be a typo. This cannot be right. Two times Andrew being wrong, I don't believe it.
Yeah, and two times in our past week's episodes. So
wow.
I hope that this is not a recurring segment, but in the interest of full disclosure, the first is while we were discussing compliance with a subpoena, which totally stand by, I was kind of riffing and talking about the investigation, and I pointed out that one of the ways in which a prosecutor can get around the assertion of Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is by immunizing the witness. And the terms that I used on that were imprecise and kind of revealed the fact that, like I say, you know, I'm not a criminal lawyer. I'm not a former prosecutor. And a former prosecutor, our buddy Randall Eisen, wrote in to kind of gently say, you might want to use these terms correctly. And I do. And I know the term, but it was just kind of an off the cuff. So here's what I said was, I said that essentially the prosecutors had the discretion to offer you a limited form of immunity where they would not use the documents that were produced against you in a subsequent proceedings, or blanket immunity, which means you can't be charged at all. And that's mostly right. But here's the terminology. Okay. The limited form of immunity is called use and derivative use immunity. And what that means is exactly what it says. If you give us this document, we will not use that document against you in a criminal proceeding, and we won't use that document to uniquely open up new leads against you in a subsequent criminal proceeding. That's a derivative use, right? And we have talked about how, you know, investigators can kind of get around that with things like the inevitable discovery doctrine. So, you know, proving you've used or derivatively used a document is often a subject of debate. But the terminology for the limited form of immunity is use immunity. And then the terminology for the larger form of immunity is called transactional immunity. And I think I use transaction in the context of talking about use. So that's really why, you know, if it were just failure to say the words, I don't know, I might have given myself a pass. Yeah. But I definitely didn't want to use transactional immunity incorrectly. And transaction, as contrasted from use, is in connection with that entire transaction. Right. So you cannot be charged for the events about which you are testifying, regardless of the source. Right. So transactional immunity is clearly broader than the use immunity. And part of what defense counsel would do is try and negotiate the best immunity deal they can. And, you know, one of the things that remains true about that discussion is in the Russia investigation, what any sensible prosecutor would do is gather as much evidence as they can so that when it comes time to deal with Flynn, they can figure out, A, do we need to immunize you at all? Can we make the case without your testimony and without your documents? Or B, if we need it, or we feel like it would be incredibly useful to help make our case stronger, what's our bargaining position relative to Michael Flynn? Right. Like, let's hypothesize that Michael Flynn has committed crimes. And at the end of the investigation, the special prosecutor is going to need to determine whether he wants Michael Flynn to walk for those crimes or not and how much he's willing to give up. So that was the point that we made. The point is still valid, but there was that sort of potentially misleading.
Just terminology, huh?
Terminology. Okay. Well, you know, look, just words do matter. And I do want to make sure that we're being accurate.
I think what I'm getting from this is we're tied on the bar exam, I think is what I'm getting.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, just everybody, exactly. We're tied. Andrew and I are tied. Was that all the wrong you were?
Sadly, uh-oh. That was uh-oh. Not
well, now,
all
yeah,
the
now you
wrong.
Might be below me on the bar. Let's see. Let's see, buddy, how you're doing.
Well, this was not on the show.
Oh.
So this is a mea culpa.
Well, then why are we talking about it? Were you wrong? Is this going to be like an argument you had with your wife where you have to admit you're wrong or something live on the show? No.
Yeah. We would have to go to five times a week. And
patrons
are
not ready to support
shows.
That particular goal.
Yeah, correct. No, this was, it was something that I did retweet on Twitter. You may have seen it, but cartoonist Berkeley Breathed, who writes the Bloom County comic strip, published what he claimed was a cease and desist letter from Mark Kasowitz, from Donald Trump's personal lawyer, demanding that they no longer use images of Donald Trump in Bloom County. And it turns out that's a joke. It's a gag letter. And it's one of those where if the subject were anyone other than Donald Trump, the fact that the letter contains the sentence, to use language that you might understand, parenthesis, per my client's wishes, end parenthesis, we will, quote, have your ass in a sling by lunch, end of quote. If that were sent on behalf of, you know, Republican President George W. Bush, you'd be like, oh, come on. Right. Like it clearly didn't. But I got to tell you, it didn't trip my bullshit detectors when I first read it. And it was only subsequently, as I was looking into some other things, that I went to Snopes and checked it out. And it turned out entirely a Photoshopped fake letter stunt organized by Berkeley Breathed, I guess, to see if we would believe that a sitting president would order his personal lawyer to say, we'll have your ass in a sling by lunch to a Sunday cartoon author. And I think the answer from all of the universe, both pro and anti-Trump, was, yeah, that seems like something that guy would do. So, but you know, we fancy ourselves to be skeptics. I try and do that. And I was not sufficiently skeptical of something that's just obviously ridiculous.
Accountability, folks. So. There you have it. Go. Well, you know, you might catch up with me on the bar. You're a question or two behind me.
I will work on it.
Dude,
I will work hard.
Try harder, would you? Okay.
Okay.
All right. And with that, now Andrew is right about everything else. So those are only the two things he's ever been wrong about. All right, Andrew, main topic of the day. It's on everyone's mind, the Comey testimony. What did we learn? Any bombshells that you can tell? Or was it pretty much a case of we already knew what he was going to say and now it's in the record? I guess we'll find out. Andrew's take. Here we go.
Yeah, I think we learned some very, very interesting things about how this investigation is going to unfold. Right. And so let's sort of start politically. The most depraved, disgusting, terrible moment of the hearings was at the end, closed out by John McCain, who is reading Trump talking points, which are essentially, well, Comey, you decided that you closed the investigation on Hillary Clinton's emails. So, you know, why aren't you also closed on this investigation? We don't know yet. It's not analogous. And it is designed, you know, we have talked multiple times that the right wing strategy is going to be, you know, a drumbeat every day of, come on, there's a special prosecutor. Why don't we know? Where there's no findings, there's no evidence. Right. And, you know, and I thought, you know, if you are holding out hope, and I have seen this in otherwise intelligent pieces by sober journalists, if you are holding out hope of John McCain being one of the first people that, you know, were able to shake free in the Senate to break with Donald Trump, this hearing should disabuse you.
Yeah, no kidding.
We also got, I think, the sort of the two main arguments that we're going to see going forward kind of framed in this hearing. So we didn't really learn anything new in the hearing. There were no bombshells. There was no new bits of information. But what we saw is the arguments sort of starting to be lined up. So the chairman, Richard Burr, asked the question of James Comey, did the president at any time ask you to drop the investigation? Right. And the answer to that was, Comey said, not with his words, no. Okay. And the reason how this is sort of going to break down is the argument, I'm not kidding, this argument was made in the hearing, is that that Comey's testimony, his written testimony, is that what Donald Trump said to him was, boy, I sure hope that you're able to drop the whole Michael Flynn thing because he's a good guy and he doesn't deserve this.
Right.
And so Republicans are making the argument, apparently in all sincerity, that saying, I hope, means it couldn't possibly be a threat. And it therefore can't be obstruction of justice because, well, I just hope for stuff. Yeah. Like I hope for stuff all the time. And I'm going to point out, I was able to find in about 15 minutes, two separate cases. Okay. And I'm going to explain very, very quickly what these cases are and how they came about. I don't want to say that they are 100% on point, but they are 99% on point. Wow. They are very, very persuasive. They are not dispositive, but they are cases in which a trial court has convicted and an appellate court, the United States Circuit Court for the Fifth Circuit in one case and the Eighth Circuit in another, have affirmed convictions for obstruction of justice based on statements that say hope.
This is crucial. Okay. So, I'm excited.
Yeah. So the one that is closest is a case called U.S. versus Bedoy, B-E-D-O-Y, 827 F3rd 495. This, again, lesson from our Travis Wester cases. This has been shepherdized. Both of these are valid cases. They have not been cited much, but they are good law and valid opinions. So U.S. versus Bedoy, the statement was, Bedoy said to a witness, I'm just hoping you haven't told anyone anything, like, you know, talking or anything like that. Just don't, you know. And, and you know, if you're like me and you love Casino and you like mobster, right? Like, people do not always communicate with, hi, my name is X and I would like to exchange money for illicit goods and service. Right? You know, like, you know, people convey threats. And Comey has testified today very clearly. No, in his words, Donald Trump said, I hope. But in his body language and the context and the substance of what he was saying, I clearly thought it was a threat. And look, I got fired. So
yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Enter into the evidence that. Yeah.
Right. Seems pretty straightforward. Now, the distinction is Bedoy is an 18 U.S.C. 1512 case, and that is witness tampering, right? The standard for witness tampering, right? This is the one that begins, whoever kills or attempts to kill any person in connection with a proceeding, or, you know, whoever uses physical force or the threat of physical force or attempts to do so with the intent to cause any person to withhold testimony. So that standard is a little different than the two statutes that are going to be used against Trump, which are 1505, obstruction of proceedings, and 1510, obstruction of criminal investigations. Those standards are, those two statutes, 1505 and 1510, use the exact same language. That language is slightly different than the language in 1505 and 1510. 1505, for example, says, whoever corruptly by threats of force or by any threatening letter or communication influences, obstructs, or impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede. So there's a little bit of distinction. Mm. Again, I would not want to be the defense lawyer trying to distinguish those cases, but I want us to fully disclose. I do not want to say there is a case involving criminal obstruction.
Yeah.
Under the statutes that apply to Donald Trump, that arguably apply to Donald Trump, that hold, I hope. But if I were briefing the case, Bedoy would be case number one that I'm saying. Right. Like it's right on. It's right on with the facts. Case number two that I would cite. And again, I've got to do more research. The hearings ended literally 15 minutes before we started recording. But, you know, I'm on the case.
Yeah, we're getting that fast response.
The second case that I found is a case called United States versus McDonald, 521 F3rd 975. That's a 2008 case from the Court of Appeals of the Eighth Circuit. That's a tiny bit more attenuated because this is not a conviction for obstruction of justice. But one of the things that is the case in the sentencing guidelines in federal court is that the sentencing guidelines are now administered in an advisory capacity. They used to be binding and they were a matrix. And you would literally say, okay, is this a first-time offender? Is this a repeat offender? What's the nature of the offense? Did you cooperate with the government? And you would get, you know, a number score, and then you would look up kind of on the matrix, okay, you know, you're a level 43 and it's your first offense, goes over, that means the judge has the discretion to award a sentence between, you know, 120 months and 135 months, right? And that's how the sentencing guidelines work. Now they're applied in a discretionary fashion. We could do a whole show on this, so I want to pause, you know, I want to go over it sort of super lightly. But one of the things that you get on the sentencing guidelines, or get makes it sound like a bonus. One of the things that happens to you is if you have attempted to obstruct justice, you get a two-level increase in that score, right? And the higher your score, the longer the sentence you're eligible for. And so this guy, Colin McDonald, pled guilty to bank robbery. And then in connection with sentencing, the government said, okay, we're going to seek an additional two levels because you tried to obstruct justice. And how did he try to obstruct justice? He wrote to a witness and said, I hope and pray to God you did not say anything about a weapon when you were in Iowa, because it will make it worse on me and you, even if they promised you not to prosecute you. That's not always true. I would hate to see you go to jail. It's a horrible place, especially since you're very sensitive. You would have God with you no matter what. Don't ever forget that. You would also have my soul to share with you everywhere you go. And then I like this because to me, this sort of apes Futurama, that at the sentencing hearing, the witness testified that when she visited McDonald in jail after his arrest, he held up a note through the glass that said, don't tell them about the knife, which has nothing to do with the Comey testimony, but was definitely funny. So the argument, and you will see this, right? Get onto social media. The argument that is circulating among Pepe the Frogheads is, I hope, is insufficient to be obstruction of justice. In other words, their argument is the president has to say, Mr. Comey, I demand that you drop all open investigations into Michael Flynn.
Right, yeah. The idea is he has to say, Mr. Comey, I am about to obstruct justice when I tell you that. Correct.
Yeah. And so, you know, there was another follow-up question from Senator Risch, who said President Trump did not direct you, Director Comey, to let it go. And again, the same answer. No, he didn't use those words. The Democrats then elicited from their testimony, you certainly interpreted this as a threat, didn't you? Yes. And I will tell you that if we're using the James Comey standard that we ourselves used back in opening arguments number 13, right, what would a reasonable prosecutor do? reasonable prosecutors make cases based on obstruction of justice using loose language like this all the time. And they make cases specifically using language of, gosh, I sure hope nothing happens here. Yeah. Right. Like, and in at least two instances. Now, are they 100% on point? I don't want to say that, but it's, I would not want to try and argue to the contrary. I mean, that it seems as close as you're likely to get in a case. And you would, in my estimation, if you went before a judge to say, I hope is not sufficient, to convict for obstruction of justice, and the other side said, what about Bedoy and what about McDonald? And you said, well, you know, the standard's slightly different for, you know, under the sentencing guideline. I think the judge would look at you and be like, really, Mr. Torres, is that the best you got? So that's kind of number one. The second thing that I thought was really, really interesting was the laziest man in the Senate, Marco Rubio, actually showed up for work today. And I thought very, very helpfully kind of described what the testimony was about. And he got Comey to admit to yes to this. He said, look, so there are really three things that the president asked you for, right? Number one, he asked you for a loyalty pledge. Number two, however we go back and forth on it, he asked you to let the Flynn thing go. That was Rubio's words, not mine. And number three, he wanted to get out what you knew and what your associates knew, which was that Trump was not under investigation at the time. And Comey said yes to that. And I think that that's helpful because it you know, sort of focuses in where the discussion is going to be. And that is, hey, let the Flynn thing go. Is that obstruction of justice? And we talked about in detail on OA70. Our analysis hasn't changed. The one last thing I would add that there were some kind of stupid questions by some of the dumber members of the Senate that were of the form. Now, there was no open investigation of President Trump at the time that he met with you at that dinner and asked you for your loyalty, right? And the answer to that is yes. And so, I have seen Trump defenders say, well, if there's not an open investigation, then how can you obstruct justice?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is, right. is what we said in OA70, which is—
You can obstruct a potential investigation.
Yeah. And number two, and more importantly, there was an open investigation in connection to Michael Flynn.
Yeah, of course.
There was a federal grand jury that had been convened and had issued subpoenas. So, you know, the idea that there was no grand jury investigation into the president at the time of the dinner is just anybody making that argument is not taking the law seriously. So that's sort of my quick guide to understanding the Comey testimony. There are hours of closed door testimony that's going on right now. And there were some really other interesting aspects. I tweeted about this. If you're not following us at Open Args on Twitter, I kind of live tweeted while the hearing was underway. I was very, very impressed with California Senator Kamala Harris. Hadn't encountered her before. She used her time to ask sensible legal questions involving Jeff Sessions' role in the process. It wasn't very sexy, but she avoided grandstanding.
Excellent.
And whenever anybody does that, I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah.
On the Republican side, I thought Burr and Risch did a good job too. And I said that, I mean, you know, given the facts that they had, which, you know, aren't very good.
Go to Open Args then and check that out. 'Cause it sounds like, fair play to the Republicans who actually tried to do their job. That's good.
So that's where we are going forward. The question is going to be, did the actions on the Flynn thing constitute obstruction of justice? It illustrates precisely what we talked about, which is we're about the interpretation of, gosh, I sure hope nothing happens to you. It's going to be amazing to me to have all these, you know, tough guy, I love the fact that Donald Trump is putting America first again, you know, all of a sudden going in and have to take the interpretation of, no, you're saying that if somebody says, I hope that you would take that as a threat? Yeah. Are you kidding me? He's just being helpful.
Yeah.
So good ammunition against your tough guy wannabe Trump supporting buddies.
And you definitely empty the room of everyone else before you're about to try to be helpful and just, you know, add a little point. Definitely make sure you're alone with the guy. Anyway, all right. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. Thanks for giving us that context. And certainly that argument of, I hope, you know, nothing happens to you or whatever, you know, that kind of language certainly that sheds some light on that. So let's go forward with the rest of the show.
So, Thomas, today's episode is brought to us by Warby Parker. And I know you are both a stylish guy and you are well known for your glasses. So I think you tried out the process. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So I actually have a friend who already uses Warby Parker and he had a great experience with it. So I was already well inclined to try them out. And so I did. And the try-on program is so cool because you just pop in the order. You can pick out the five pairs of glasses that you like based on the website, you know, so you can get a wide diversity of looks, you know, because picking out glasses is not easy. Like I used to do it at the, you know, the weird optometrist where there's some old lady and you're like, do these look good? And you're like, I can't trust her opinion on anything.
I never know if I'm standing in front of the women's case or not. And but you ever have that? Like, look, I know that Jackie O glasses are not for me.
But this try-on program, it gives you the chance to look at them on the website and you pick five that you like. And I picked out my five and I said, oh, these all look interesting. I'm going to try them out. And you can get, you know, you can try the same frame, but a different color, or you can go with the same color, but a different kind of frame. You get it really quickly in a neatly packaged little set and you pop them on and you can try them on. You can take pictures with them. You can really see what they look like on you first before you order them, because the last thing you want to do is order glasses that you haven't even tried on, you know, that you don't know if they like you said, Andrew, you don't want to order them. You realize they're actually Jackie O's glasses.
Yeah. And Warby Parker actually they have an iTunes app, which I thought was kind of neat. After you order the glasses, their try-on companion allows you to take pictures of you, you know, trying on all the five different pairs of glasses. You put it into a video and you can share it out, have your podcast co-hosts or if you have other friends, you know, vote in and tell you which one they like the best, which that's important to me because I'm always embarrassed to ask how I look in certain things. So.
Ask what other people think you look. They're the ones who are going to see you in the glasses. You're just seeing through them, but you can try them on
Parker,
for comfort.
We're not for narcissists. There you go.
You can try them on for comfort and fit and all that. Glasses start at $95, which is a great rate for glasses. It's possible to pay a whole heck of a lot more elsewhere, as I know, because I worked at an ophthalmology practice, as I've talked about before.
Yeah. My last sunglasses were a lot more than that. And yeah, no, then I lost them like 2 weeks later.
And the lenses have that anti-glare and anti-scratch coating, which is absolutely essential for me. I'm not even joking about that. I accidentally didn't get that one time and it was terrible. So you want to get those. And this is really cool. For every pair you buy, a pair is distributed to someone in need. Just as a reminder, make sure you go to warbyparker.com/lawpod to try these out. Get your five frames. Hey, if you want to tag us, we'll give you our opinion. If you want to tag us with your pictures, we'll be like, okay, here's the one that makes you look the most lawyery. And then, you know, it'll increase your score on the bar exam by at least 5-10%. Can I make that claim, Andrew? Is that legal?
Yeah, increase on the bar exam, not guaranteed.
WarbyParker.com/lawpod. All right, Andrew, breaking down the law.
Down. 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 Down.
Oh, yes. A lot of people asked about this. Breaking news. No matter how hard we try, they're still breaking news after we record, which I wish they just wouldn't do. You know, like, can they just kindly stop with any breaking news after we record on Thursday? But no, there was some news last week after we recorded about the SCOTUS appeal of the Muslim ban. And then also there was Trump out and out calling it a ban on Twitter. Like, no, it is definitely a ban. Don't believe what my lawyers are trying to say. It was virtually that. Like, it wasn't even, I didn't even just exaggerate. Like, it pretty much was that. So what's going on there? Catch us up.
Yeah. So what is happening is we talked about how after the president issued a revised executive order on the so-called Muslim ban, it was enjoined, that is, two separate courts entered a temporary restraining order that prevented that EO from going into effect. One was in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, and the other was in the United States District Court for the District of Maryland by a judge whom I know fairly well. And despite the fact that Trump came out and blamed the Ninth Circuit for these two district court opinions, as it turns out, the Fourth Circuit, which is the court to which the District of Maryland case was appealed, heard and ruled first on the issue.
Awesome.
And, you know, that. So now we're going to have to break up the fourth circuit, which is going to be confusing.
There's going to be like 163 circuits by the time we're done with this. And then they'll all strike down whatever he does. So he's actually, it's the thing where you cut, like, you know, Mickey Mouse in half and there's two Mickey, or no, what is it? The brooms? What is that? Fantasia?
Right. Yeah, Fantasia. Yeah, exactly. Breaking up the Fourth Circuit would actually totally frustrate Trump's goals, because the Fourth Circuit is comprised of Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia. And so, as you might imagine, it's a politically complicated circuit, other than it is pretty conservative on law and order, you know, criminal rights issues. It's the Fourth Circuit precedent is pretty bad on things like search and seizure, self-incrimination, those kinds of issues. If you were to segregate out the Maryland judges, you would create another very liberal circuit. And and that would totally frustrate
if Trump's you strike intent. Them down, they'll return strike.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely is the broomstick. So that Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling very much tracked the previous rulings that we've seen on this issue. It was an en banc hearing. There were only three judges in dissent, and it continues to apply, you know, the operative standard, the framework that we've talked about from the very beginning, which is the City of Hialeah case, which says, you know, ordinarily we try not to discern intent from, you know, what was going on in the legislators' heads, or in this case, in the president's head. But when they make it impossible for us to ignore, we can't do that. And it really, you know, creates this kind of interesting situation where there's a tension, which is the only way. And I think that this helps cast light on what is really going on here. And I know we have an increasing number of conservative listeners. So if they disagree with this, write in, let us know. But it seems to me...
Did Dan the conservative man have a kid or something? Is that what
happened? Yeah. No, they're a couple. I've gotten a couple emails that are like, I'm a right-leaning listener to OA, and I appreciate that you guys are straight shooters. So let me put it this way. The way in which you get around the City of Hialeah problem is by doing... We're using that parenthetically. I do understand not everybody has listened to every single episode of Opening Arguments. You should.
Yeah, we shouldn't even. I mean, why are you even pandering to people like that? I mean, everyone should have listened to every episode.
Right. But the City of Hialeah case, that's a Supreme Court decision in which the City of Hialeah wanted to ban a Santeria temple. There was an acquisition of a piece of property. So they passed a law forbidding certain kinds of treatment of animals in public. They exempted Christian and Jewish religious ceremonies. And,
and they were clear in when they did it that they were doing this for this reason. They essentially tweeted, this is a ban, pretty much.
Yeah, right. And the 90s equivalent of tweeting that was appearing in public at the hearings on the bill, where county council members would say, this is an affront to all good God-fearing Christians, and we have to stop that Santeria. It's voodoo. It's been banned in Cuba. Why would we allow that here?
We get our best laws from Cuba, by the way. That's how we legislate.
Right. And so what the City of Hialeah did was after losing on this, they quietly kind of went. And so the Supreme Court said, in this case, when you openly testify about how much you hate a religion and want to shut it down, then we will scrutinize your actions undertaken after having said that and apply strict scrutiny because it is discrimination against a protected class on prohibited grounds. And so they struck down the law. And then what happened was a couple of years later, the City of Hialeah got together and they said, we in no way care about how this impacts religion at all. Yeah. We are concerned about the health impacts of people sacrificing chickens in public squares. And therefore, we want to pass this ordinance, which will make it illegal to sacrifice chickens. And if it happens to have the effect of preventing, Mormons from practicing their, we're really, really sorry, but this is in no way intended to to single out a particular religious group. And everybody, you know, it's a tiny city. We knew what we were doing, and they were able to get subsequent neutral sounding bill passed. Trump could do that.
Yeah. We've all been thinking he was going to.
It would not be hard for him to have a press conference, for him to have a public meeting in the Oval Office that is, you know, open to cameras, in which he gets around and says, look, everybody, we're here. We know the Supreme Court has struck, well, I'm assuming the Supreme Court is going to strike it down, but who knows? That's still, he could still win in the Supreme Court. We'll get to that in a minute. But he could get together and say, look, multiple courts have struck down our executive order, which was intended to protect the United States against dangerous immigration and to give us time to figure out what's going on. And they've done that because I and others on my administration have said intemperate things. And we've done that in the height of political season. And that was a mistake. And so what I really want us to do is sit here in this room and powwow and come up with a way, legally, constitutionally, where I can discharge my duties and protect the American people without discriminating against Muslims, without enacting a Muslim ban. And let's do that. Right. And if that were a part of the record, it would be incredibly difficult to make the argument that they're making now. Right. The argument.
And this is why it's just so hilarious to see him self-destruct and melt down in this way.
But it's not, in my view, it's not a self-destruction. Right. It's not a melting down. If he were to do that, then 10 million people with Pepe the Frog icons on Twitter are going to say, I can't believe our president had to sell out to the, you know, liberal SJW.
I don't know. I hate to disagree with you because I know you're always right, except for the two times that you said today.
Yeah. And next week when we do this.
But when I had Trump supporter Dr. Price on my podcast, Serious Inquiries Only, which, gosh, check that out if you're interested in a debate with a Trump supporter. And he had towed the Trump line on everything. And the Trump storyline was, it's not a Muslim ban because out of all the Muslim countries in the world, most of them aren't on it. Like, that was the talking point. So I think he actually could have gotten away with it with his base. You know what I mean? Like, I think they were willing to, because I think his base knows what's going on too. I think his base would know, okay, this is actually a Muslim ban, but because of the courts, we need to, you know, everybody cool it on that. The only person who can't figure that out is Trump. it's hilarious to me.
It is. And I would add, in furtherance of your argument, is the datum that you and I have continued to point to, which is the Quinnipiac poll and other polls that have shown Donald Trump's approval rating sort of hovering between 36 and 39. All of that downward movement is Democrats and independents. Mm. If you look at the partisan breakdown, Trump's approval rating among Republicans has hovered between, it's a straight line.
Yeah, it really
with
is.
Little wobbles in it. And it's hovered between 80 and 84. And I keep my eye on those polls because, you know, when you get asked the Trump impeachment question, which I get asked approximately 15,000 times a day, I say, look, when that line starts trending downward is when we can talk.
Yeah.
But not until that line starts trending down. And the fact that Donald Trump could be at 85% approval rating among Republicans right now is something I find difficult to comprehend.
Yeah.
But
this might be a little off topic, but I do want to point out that when I did that episode comparing the approval ratings, I mean, Nixon still only went, it's not as though Nixon went to zero Republican, you know, he went from 85 to, I want to say 60 or something Republican and maybe down to like 55, but I don't think he even dipped below 50 for just Republicans, by the way.
I think that makes two really good points, right? Number one, that people who are sort of decrying the state of partisan politics today, you do have a point, right? Like, I think that partisan politics today are worse than they have ever been, but they're not so, you know, in other words, this is not a problem we invented in 2004, right?
Like, but it is worse
that
now.
That partisan identity politics has been a part of our politics, you know, for as long as I can remember and as long as historical records seem to bear out.
Right. But the only other point I made was that the gap used to be smaller. Like, if you used to look at, you know, whoever the party in power was, their approval rating, you know, that would obviously be on the top for the president. They'd have the most approval. Independents would be in the middle, and then the opposing party would be below that, of course. But it was clustered far more together historically, and it's just gotten further and further apart. Where the party in power is way up high, the party not in power is way down low, and the independents are somewhere in the middle, and it really has spread out. And I do think it's getting worse. But yeah, you're right that it wasn't invented yesterday with Trump or anything.
And number two, I think it gives us a good benchmark, right? Like, you're correct. We are not waiting for Robert M. Price to abandon Donald Trump. That's not going to happen. That's not going to, that probably wouldn't happen. I mean, and everybody should listen to that SIO episode. That was, it was amazing. But I don't think that would happen if we had the proverbial, you know, black and white photo of, you know, a Russian operative handing over a briefcase full of money, you know, zoomed in on the money to Donald Trump, right? Like, I mean, when you're sort of that far down the rabbit hole, you know, I'm not trying to persuade you at this point, but the question is, how many folks have you picked off? And you've got to pick off more than 10, 15%, right? You've got to get that number trending downward into the 70s, into the 60s. And at that point, then the calculus, and you know, we've talked about this in our gerrymandering episodes, then the calculus shifts from, I am most vulnerable to being primaried from the right by a Trump supporter for failing to be insufficiently supportive, to I am most vulnerable in the general election, even though my district is R plus nine. Right. And that's when those folks get shaken loose. Again, helpful metric, right? We want to use Nixon's approval rating among Republicans. And the second thing is, remember, for the Democrats to take back the Senate in 2018, they have to win either Ted Cruz's or Orrin Hatch's seat. Mm. So you got to put yourself in the mind of the average constituent in Texas or Utah. And that's right. That's the standard I'm kind of using in the back of my mind of, you know, what is this? What does this rise to the level of?
Yeah.
And, you know, and we talked about that a little bit in the main segment of this episode. But, you know, that's, to me, that's the top of Yodel Mountain.
Yeah.
Right. At the point where Ted Cruz's constituents are like, yeah, I get it. But like, yeah, you know, this, I don't care what happens. Trump's got to go.
Yeah.
And look, there's a way to build that infrastructure too, right? Which is to say, once conservatives start talking about the benefit of having Mike Pence in office, right? Then, you know, then it's no longer, you know, as quite as much of an ask. And the way you get there is by having Republican candidates be more afraid of losing the general election than they are being primary. But we've kind of wandered off the the Muslim ban.
Yeah, we have. I just want to, just so I don't have to do any sort of Andrew's was wrong. I think when I'm wrong in the future, I'll still do an Andrew was wrong segment and just say you were wrong. But I just looked it up just to verify. Nixon's Republican support did dip a couple times to 48, but Gallup has him at, when he left office, Republican support at exactly 50%. So just to give you some idea of what we're dealing with when it comes to partisanship.
Right. And that is, look, in my view, that is after, you know, kind of like that Simpsons episode of Homer falling down Springfield Gorge, right? Like that is several steps after falling off the top of the mountain, right? Like Trump doesn't have to be at 50 among Republicans, but he's got to at least drop to just below 70% among Republicans is kind of the magic number I'm looking for. So what's going on with the travel ban? The Fourth Circuit affirmed the District Court of Maryland, and the Trump administration has done the following things. And this has been reported in a really sort of confusing and misleading manner. So let's try and clarify what they've done. Number one, they have petitioned for a writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court. And that either has been granted or will be granted. We've talked about how a petition for cert requires four votes. And obviously there are four votes to hear the case. And it should be heard. Number two, they've petitioned to be heard on an expedited basis. Number three, they have petitioned to stay the Fourth Circuit's judgment pending resolution of their appeal on the merits. And so now we're talking about moving to stay a temporary restraining order, right? Because remember, the merits of the travel ban are still not, they are still pending at the district court level, right? Like we haven't gotten there yet. All of these appeals have been appeals of the TRO, which stops the EO from going into effect.
Oh, right.
Right. Yep. So we've yet to hear arguments on the merits.
Yeah.
The reason we hear things that sound like arguments on the merits, at Thomas, as you know from your voluminous law studies, is because you have to I'm serious about that one, right? Is because you have to demonstrate a likelihood of success on the merits in order to get your injunctive relief, right? So you have this sort of weird situation where you have to convince the court, arguing in broad terms on an issue they haven't decided, that you're probably going to win on that issue that they haven't decided. So here's the unique kind of twist that we want to look at going forward. And that is, Trump has moved to stay the Fourth Circuit's ruling on the upholding the TRO. A petition to stay is subjected to almost exactly the same kind of standards as the granting of the TRO in the first place. But the burden shifts to the person who is making the argument. So in other words, Trump's lawyers will have to demonstrate before the Supreme Court that, among other things, they have a likelihood of success on the merits of their case in order to stay the enforcement of the Fourth Circuit's judgment and then permit the EO to go into effect. And if I were to wager on that, and I've been, you know, I've had varying degrees of success, I think it is going to be a difficult proposition to get five votes, right? He's going to get four, right? He's going to get Roberts, he's going to get Thomas, he's going to get Alito, and he's going to get the new Scalia in Neil Gorsuch. I say he's going to get Roberts. I would say there's a 20% chance he doesn't get Roberts. I don't believe that he is going to get Anthony Kennedy to say, as a matter of law, that I am going to join in with a majority opinion granting a stay of the Fourth Circuit's ruling that the government has demonstrated a likelihood of success on the merits. I think if you ask me how I think this is likely to turn out, I think it's going to be a 5-4 denial of the motion to stay, and that Anthony Kennedy is going to file a separate concurrence, right? The four liberal justices are going to say the government has not demonstrated likelihood of success on the merits. And Anthony Kennedy is going to say, I think this is an open question. I write separately concurring in the judgment because I think it is an open question whether the government is going to prevail on the merits, and we won't know that until we've heard the case.
Interesting.
So that's how I think that's going to go. And then I think the there's some chance that might be a Kennedy Roberts. And I say that based on the fact that John Roberts has, I think, some personal investment in maintaining the notion of being nonpartisan, of being nonpolitical.
Yeah, I like the detailed prediction there. That's really cool. It's not just general thing. I think taking us through your thoughts on that is really cool. It sounds like Roberts really depends on the burden. Like if he's going to say, it's an open question. So, you know, I can't say either way. Then it really just depends where the burden is, which you pointed out. It's now shifted to the Trump team.
Okay. Correct. Now on the merits, I've got to tell you, I mean, I will be very, very interested in how that comes out. We have said from the very beginning that, you know, absent the kind of amazing way in which the Trump administration has handled this and other issues and sort of invoked its own city of Hialeah problem, absent that, there's no argument, right? Like we've been through, the only arguments that are going forward at this point are First Amendment arguments based on discriminatory animus.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't that still, I remember initially when we talked about this, you were pretty confident he could do whatever because, you know, he's got the statutory power, but didn't it become a little less clear that maybe the First Amendment would prevent him from prioritizing or restricting people of a certain ethnic or religious group, and you weren't sure how that was going to play out, or was that truly just in his motivation for it?
Yeah, that all falls within the motivations. Oh, okay. The first EO had severe due process violations as we talked about on the show, it swept together, I mean, kind of incredibly, it swept together, you know, folks who had a pre-existing right to return to the United States, along with people who had, you know, never even applied. Yeah. And that created the due process problem. The second EO was, you know, as we said, the Ninth Circuit gave the Trump administration sort of the blueprint of how to fix this, and they followed it in terms of the written words, but nobody advised them that also meant, you know, ixnay on the Uslim may when you're talking about it.
You can't tell Trump what to do is the problem. No one can tell him what to do.
So, I've always been skeptical of the First Amendment argument. I think it's possible I think it's still possible that that loses.
And when you say that, you mean regardless, so like pretending he just did the same ban, but with no Muslim ban language or anything like that. If they were just restricting certain countries, and even though we all know like these are Muslim countries, you're not confident, or maybe are you confident that it wouldn't be unconstitutional just on that basis, that the First Amendment stuff is all based on how they're describing the language, you know, how they're describing their motivations for doing it.
Yeah, I think it's the latter, that without Trump's public statements, which, you know, we've talked about in prior episodes, but, you know, that coming out at the third debate going, no. Like, let me tell you, we're still doing the Muslim ban. We're just calling it extreme vetting. Extreme vetting is the Muslim ban. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Like that. That's a really hard statement to get
Andy, around, and you know? That's not the end of it. I mean, he literally
his
tweets were, it's a ban.
Right, 2 days ago. Right. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this, we've gone back and forth on the, you know, President Trump versus President Pence. If you had somebody in office who valued getting the substance of this executive order passed, I think he could do that.
Yeah. And it has to be pointed out, I don't think it makes a difference legally, you can tell me, but it just has to be pointed out that the whole rationale for this ban was, oh, for 90 or so days while we figure out what's going on. Well, you've had more than that to figure out what's going on. And they, you know, apparently that wasn't, that must not have been the rationale. By now, you should have said, well, we didn't get the ban in place, but we figured out what was going on. So, you know, everything's fine. But no. Does that matter legally, though? Like if he said, if the rationale in the executive order is we need this short-term ban to, you know, enable it to figure out our extreme vetting, you know, to make time to figure out what's going on. Does that matter legally at all? The fact that that time has passed or no?
Yeah. So when we look at Executive Order 13780, this is the revised so-called Muslim ban. Section one has the policy and purpose standards, and it says that the screening and vetting protocols play a crucial role in detecting foreign nationals who may commit, aid, or support acts of terrorism. It's therefore the policy of the United States to improve the screening and vetting protocols. And then it reinforces the history of, to implement this policy, I issued Executive Order 13769, which suspended for 90 days, blah, blah, blah. So yes, in some way, that rationale is referenced in Section 1 of the revised executive order, which is 13780. So, yeah, I think those arguments are on the table. They so far have not been made at the Supreme Court level. One of the things that's very, very interesting about arguing before the Supreme Court is, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of what, you know, nine unbelievably smart and, well, of what eight unbelievably smart lawyers and Clarence Thomas want to do. And they can, you know, they can take you in sort of all sorts of directions. So I wouldn't say it's over 50% likely, but it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, one of the justices from the court's liberal wing sort of asked the, you know, 90-day question, you know, and said, you know, of Trump's lawyers, look, it says here, you know, you want to improve the vetting and screening process. And we're now 90 to 120 days out. And, you know, what has that bought you? Yeah. I get it that folks are still coming in. So you think that that's still a problem, right? And that your defense doesn't just rest on that. But part of your rationale was, let's figure this out. And what have you figured out?
Yeah.
And I could see
so
that.
So it could factor in. That's interesting. Okay.
It could.
Good to know. All right. Well, now it's that great time of the week when we've got to thank our top patron. And they are Roger Metcalf, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Amanda Lipnack, Heather Loveridge, Geeker41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Ali, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, Heath Enright, Jeffrey Maynor, The Wayward Willis, Matthew Maxson of the Odd Atheist Friends Podcast, Dave Lovely, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Sharon Frankel, host of the delightful podcast Habeas Humor, Squick Thinger, Ian Ryan, Matthew Hillier, and Aaron Grady.
Yeah, and thank you to Brandon Smith, TV is My Girlfriend, Seasick Sarah, Hunter Ash, Torsten Skurve, Adopt a Homeless Pet, and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking. Philip Stromberg, the You Are Here sci-fi audio drama, which was by our amazing editor, Brian Ziegenhagen. Thank you so much. He is awesome. RJ, the bleeding-eared plebeian, Ratio, Thomas's Missing Feet, Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical, CampQuest.org. Torsten Peel of Prosperity Karma and Placebo Mart. Where do we get these placebos? JT loves his hubby Logan, Soggy Pants, Sammy, give Thomas this easy name. Sorry, I'm taking it. The Squaring the Strange podcast, Valerie Dubrille, John Bodley Esquire, Kaylee Reiser, Sakashite Fukasumi, Michael Schaefer of Reason Real Estate, the Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org, the NetSec Heathen, Jessica Wilson, Mark Smith, Thomas McCormick, Dan Griffith, Frederick Alstromer, Reven, Michael Rops, Marissa Alexa McCool, Conrad Michaels, and our top patron, Zabby.
Thanks very much, guys. It's one of our favorite days for a reason. And now it's time. Ugh. All right, bar exam, no, whatever.
No, no, no. This is going to be awesome. You're in issue spotting mode. Okay. We're going to right the ship.
Sure.
Here. So here we go.
Hey, you know what? Never mind. I take it back. Redo it. It's time for me successfully for like 10 times in a row, eliminating two answers from the bar exam. I'm on a roll. God, I'm so good at this. Let's go.
Okay. A man was a passenger in a vehicle stopped at a red light. A drunk driver with a blood alcohol reading four times the legal limit rammed into the rear of the stopped vehicle without braking and at a high speed. The passenger was severely and permanently injured. At trial, the drunk driver admitted liability so that the trial dealt with damages only. Okay. The drunk driver testified that he had no assets to pay a punitive damages award. He said that all he had was $100,000 in liability coverage. The court allowed the injured man's attorney to cross-examine the driver about his insurance coverage, and he elicited an admission that the driver knew that his company might have to pay the full award of the jury. The jury entered a verdict for $200,000 in compensatory damages and $500,000 in punitive damages. Defendant appealed, claiming that it was improper to question on the amount of insurance coverage or to speculate on whether the full amount may have to be paid. Will the appellate court likely affirm the award of punitive damages?
Holy crap. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's a complicated fact pattern, but the question is about the particular testimony regarding the insurance coverage, right? And so question asks, remember that the defendant testifies on direct that he has no assets to pay a punitive damage award.
Yeah,
he's asked in cross-examination about the coverage, and he admits, oh, yeah, well, I know my insurance company's going to pay for it.
Mm.
So now, question is, will the appellate court likely affirm the award of punitive damages given that that took place, or was that improper? So, A, no, the punitive damages award cannot be excessively high and cannot exceed three times the compensatory damages amount. B, no, because it is never proper to bring insurance information into the case against the defendant. C, yes, because defendant opened the door to that kind of cross-examination by testifying that he had no assets to pay a punitive damage award. Or D, yes, because the jury always has a right to be informed of the insurance coverage pertaining to each party in a tort case for personal injury damages.
Wow. This is a weird question.
It is.
Now, I'll stick with my normally eliminating two method here. So okay. I think that D has got to be wrong. I mean, the jury always has a right to be informed of the insurance coverage pertaining to each party in a tort case for personal injury damages. That doesn't, I mean, I'm hoping that's wrong. It's that always language. And if that's right, I'm screwed. so I'm eliminating D. And then I would say, I guess if we're going to stick to this heuristic of always or never language being most of the time wrong, then I think the no, because it is never proper to bring insurance information into the case against the defendant, I think that's, I'll eliminate that too, because, a never language kind of thing. So I'm going to go with eliminating B and D for my official second chance bar exam, second chance law firm. So I'm going, so A, the reason I'm on A or C is like, if it's true that punitive damages cannot exceed 3 times the compensatory damages, then that could easily be a right answer. However, I don't think that's true from my memory of every, you know, lawsuit. We talk about the McDonald's thing, the coffee lawsuit. Like, I don't think that's how punitive damages work, especially because compensatory damages could be like nothing. You could be like, okay, sure, you stepped on this man's toe, so you're gonna have to pay him $3 for a Band-Aid, for, you know, box of Band-Aids or something. But the judge or the jury or whatever, however it works, might have a reason to want to really dissuade this behavior, and so they might make the punitive damages really high. I don't think any such limit exists. So I'm gonna go with C. Because it seems like, yeah, the defendant opened the door to that kind of cross-examination, as we've learned from Lot Awful Movies, sort of, that you can go there once the defendant goes there. Looking forward to being wrong on this one, but I'm hoping my eliminating two streak is alive. So my official answer is C. My official eliminations were B and D.
Okay. And if you would like to guess A or any other answer, but A is Thomas's last answer that he failed to eliminate, you may do so playing along with Thomas Takes the Bar Exam on Twitter. What you do is take our announcement and quote and retweet it, hashtag TTTBE, put in your answers, put in fun stuff, put in pictures, explain why you came to your results. This, I think more and more people are doing this every week. I know a lot of people are having fun with it, and we always have fun with your answers. So keep sharing the show, keep playing along, and maybe this is the week that Thomas turns it around.
Nah. I don't give people, well, no, I get it. You're trying to get throw people off. Yeah, maybe. Oh yeah, maybe this is the, sure. Don't definitely guess A.
Either way, we've definitely learned something here today.
All right. Well, that does it for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for Andrewing. Thanks so much for patronizing everybody who patronizes us over at patreon.com/law. And you're getting those episodes, the Tuesday episode, a bit earlier because of our editor, who I also need to thank, Brian. Thank you so much. You're getting those earlier. So that's another good reason to sign up over on patreon.com/law. And with that said, that does it for today. We'll see you next week for some more opening arguments. See you then.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.